What's good, everybody, and welcome to Body Bag Podcast. I'm Chris Thomas, and with me, as always, Broke Writer Dave.
How we doing, everybody?
I think our guest today is now in the running for most individual interviews we've had now. I think it's between him and Christopher Frost.
Yeah.
And it's just a lot, you know, Christopher Robertson is our guest today, author of the October Society, which is actually going to be our next big upcoming giveaway. The complete October Society is going to be our next big giveaway. Laser Lizards and Cotton Candy Massacre. Recently, Part Toots just came out. Christopher Robertson, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. You guys just can't get enough of Christopher's, can you?
No, we can't. Yeah. You just can't go wrong when you gamble on a Chris.
No.
Definitely not, yeah.
I mean, works for Disney.
Oh, yeah. How many Chris's are in the Marvel Universe just right now?
Not enough.
Yeah, not enough, yeah. David, please, take it away, dude.
So, Christopher, it's been about a year since we had you last on. So, what have you been working on in between being on here?
That has really been a year.
Time really does fly. Yeah. I lose track of... I think last time you came on, you were just getting ready to release Part Toots.
Yeah.
So I farted Part Toots out. Sorry. since then, God, there's so much has gone wrong and not come out and changed around. I released a book called Baby Doll back in February through D&T Publishing, which is a very smutty horror comedy.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, very nice.
Very, 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 very explicit.
I welcome that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the most common response was, the fuck is wrong with you and the fuck is wrong with me for liking it?
Do you consider yourself like, I did a good job when somebody, when you get somebody to be like that?
My favorite reviews or anything I see myself is like, the fuck is wrong with this guy? Or does he need help?
Yeah. That's the point of entertainers. You got to push the boundaries. That's what makes art fun.
Check his hard drives, another one I've had a few times.
Check his hard drive. Check his browser history.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm in so much shit. My browser history is just, I just will type, you know, I'm not going to say the stuff I'm typing into it because I'm pretty sure if I'm getting looked into one day, they're going to be like, well, all signs were there.
We knew it was just a matter of time before he snapped. So,
plus, some of it contains spoilers.
It's so you had mentioned, you know, I was reading up on some of your other books. Can you tell me a little bit about the Godless 666 Awards? Which you are a winner, if I'm not mistaken, of.
Yeah, so Godless is a really cool indie platform for underground and splatter and horror that you will not find on the mainstream. It's digital only. They support authors really well by giving you like the lion's share of the royalties from your book sales.
Oh, very nice.
I forget the percentages exactly, but with Amazon, it's like something like 60% you get to keep somewhere in that region. And with Godless, it's 90.
Oh, that can't beat that.
Yeah, it might have changed around a little bit. It might be a little bit off the numbers, but they're in those ballparks. And it's just been a really good place for, especially for authors who are just, Amazon are not going to promote your stuff. They're not going to email people to tell you about, you know, blender babies and stuff like that. Like, it's a home to some of the most extreme and messed up stuff.
What was your piece that put you above all the other disturbed individuals?
Well, so I do all my own publishing and everything myself, and I'm trying to figure out as I go. I'm by no means an expert or all that knowledgeable. So I was reaching out and looking for ways to break out of the Amazon self-publishing paradigm. And someone had recommended Godless to me. I think it was a fellow Scottish author, Jamie Court, who writes Sock Puppet Erotica.
Okay. I love it.
Yeah.
Writing that down.
he drew my attention to Godless, and I got in touch with Drew, who runs Godless, and made the Cotton Candy be published there. And yeah, it was up there. They ran an awards thing that was entirely voted on by readers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I campaigned a little bit for it. Like, I made a couple of posts, a couple of like little animated videos and stuff, just thinking, oh, I'll go for it. Not seriously expecting to get anywhere or anything. And then I get like an email through like a little bit before it telling me not only had I won the best novel, the gold, like the top one, it was by a considerable margin.
Wow. That must have been a huge ego boost.
Yeah. Well, to the point where he said that he had to look into it personally to make sure it was legitimate.
Like, make sure you weren't cheating, make sure you didn't bribe a bunch of people.
And he was like, it's like, no. And then also that the audiobook came in second place. So like that one, that side really goes to Lox Productions, like Alana Nicole, Alana, who does the Cotton Candy audiobooks.
You know who we're talking about if you're listening.
Sorry, Alana. Yeah.
But speaking of audiobooks, I'm currently listening to My Zombie Sweetheart.
Ooh. Oh, they went so hard on that. Alana and our partner Adrian at Lox, like with the split cast voice acting, the sound effects.
But what's like the process of taking one of your books and getting it into the audio format?
It's actually really accessible for indie authors to do it themselves. You through a website called ACX, which is another part of one of Amazon's many, many tentacles, you can post auditions for narrators for your audiobooks, and they have various different pricing strategies. So you can go like a full royalty split, where you and the audio producer keep like split the royalties 50-50 between you, if you want to kind of attract, you know, a higher profile narrators that, and then again might make your book more visible and stuff like that. They tend to want like either a royalty share plus, where it's like it's 50-50, but they also want a fee. And then there's just, if you've got the financial options, you could just outright pay the narrator, then you get to keep all royalties going forward.
Do you have really any say, or do you pick your narrator? Or
yes, so you post an audition and usually pick like a couple of different segments from the book, trying to get a range of your of who you want to hear, what scenes are going to be most important. And people will send you like audition audio files for what you've written. My worry when I was doing it was, I don't want to have to send people rejection emails. I'm such a coward.
Right.
When it comes to this sort of
thing. I would hate, like, that's why I hate doing like any kind of constructive criticism, because I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't want you thinking that I'm crapping on you. No, it's,
yeah. Well,
fortunately, once you click send an offer on someone, it just automatically sent a standard like rejection offer to everyone else. And I didn't have to do it, and I was like, oh god, I can walk away and like pretend I didn't just upset a bunch of people. But
yeah, that's got to be rough.
Yeah,
you, well, as an author, you know it's hard to like just kind of get out there.
Yeah
there was like a, it's a, the situation with the audiobook, you've got control, and you've got to like try and make the right decision for yourself. And I did have, I'm not going to say names, but I did have a more high profile narrator who made an offer, wanted to work on the book, because they would have taken a lower cut. They would have taken like a lower cut because they just really wanted to voice some crazy killer clowns. And I was a little bit starstruck because I'd listened to them doing other audiobooks before, and I was like, oh, this is going to be so cool. And then Alana sent in her audition, and if you've read the book, you know about like Sully and her singing. She was actually singing as Sully in the audition, and I was like, no, that has to be it, because to me, that's part of the core of the book, is the humor and the meta-ness and the silliness. And she was actually singing as the character in the audition, and she was the only one that did that.
That kind of put her above.
Yeah, I was like, no, that has to be.
If money was no object, and you could. And you could have the kind of, I'm going to kind of steal one of Dave's questions and turn it around. If you could have your dream narrator, who do you think has the voice that would be perfect for one of your stories? If, like celebrity, let's say, if money was no object and you could have them on a feature.
I would love the dude who played Kyle Reese in The Terminator to narrate Laser Lizards.
All right, that's it.
We're
going right into Laser Lizards, because I had a whole bunch of questions on Laser Lizards. just because I absolutely love how 80s retro it is, and like just the cover alone, I love the 80s VHS or like an old video game cartridge.
Yeah, see, if I knew we were going to talk about, we should have just done this episode on the Terminator or something.
Because it's so funny how we just went into that, because I had like a whole bunch of questions for that. I'll just go into one of the questions real quick. When you're writing, first off, this says it is 1999, the future.
Yes.
A combination of the future and present. when you're writing something science fiction like this, do you just go all out in making the world, or do you try to, keep yourself grounded at all in terms of like world building, or do you just go screw it, we're just gonna get nuts?
So there's got to always be a internal consistency to your world. So even if it's a completely fictional, made up world, the people that live in it still have to follow whatever laws and physics and things exist in that world. So I never write science fiction or fantasy stuff where I'm just like anything could happen. No, it's got to happen within the realm of possibility, the window of possibility for this world I've created. You could expand that window a little bit as you develop the plot more, or you delve into sequels and things. But I think once you've got established your key themes and key tones and your key concepts, you've got to work with them. Right, you can bend them, but you can't really break them.
I would imagine I would have to have like sheets of paper, just like, here are the rules of my place. Just remember this as I'm writing forward, and I would have to just keep these up front and be like, all right, I can do that, I cannot do that.
Yeah, I'm not really good at keeping notes though, so I just make a mess and fix it later.
Hey, whatever method you got, whatever works.
Yeah, cause it's working.
Yeah, like the Cotton Candy books, for instance, the character Stacy wasn't even in the book to begin with. She popped in as I started writing. And then I'd come up with like a way to turn her back from being a clown. So I thought, well, they're turned into clowns by corrupt cotton candy. So, you know, what breaks down, what works, what's the antithesis of sugar? And I was like, in my day job, I was actually doing training to work with people with diabetes at the time. Well, insulin, that makes sense to me. No, it makes no fucking sense at all. There's no scientific logic behind it, but it's consistent and makes sense in that world.
Yeah, so long as it makes sense in that world, that's all that matters.
And now it's become like a core component of the series, because the second book, you know, is all about trying to turn someone who's turned into a clown back to human. And like the insulin shot in that book is like a very precious silver bullet, because it's the only one they've got on hand. So you only got one shot at this.
Yeah.
I will say that Cotton Candy Massacre and Part 2 are probably... When we do the giveaways and we like announce like our guests on the show, the Cotton Candy Massacre is probably one of the more popular, like people like it when we announce that we're giving away Cotton Candy Massacre. You came out with Part 2. Is there any more for this world? Is there going to be
Part 3? So
part 3 was teased at the very end of Part 2 with a cliffhanger post credit type scene. And oddly enough, it's almost a year since Part 2 came out. So I'll be posting a little bit of a thank you on that day to thank everyone who's helped make the series such a success. But a couple of days after that, just keep watching, because there'll be a couple of announcements coming. But most readers of the second book that will see that there is the Cotton Candy Massacre Part 3. I think I posted about it earlier on in the year with just a cryptic number of 3 spelled out from candy corn.
That's cool.
Yeah,
and, I like little teaser things like that.
But yeah, so the candy corn ties into the Halloween setting and quite a lot of the plot.
Okay,
all right, cool. Dave, you said that you're currently listening to.
Like I said, I started listening to My Zombie Sweetheart on Audible. What other of your works do you have on there to listeners to look for?
So it's just those two at the moment. The Part 2 audio is actually finished, and I just need to finish going through to approve every little edit and chapter, upload the artwork, and then that's straight off to be the approval process, which hopefully won't take too long. So Part 2 audio will be hopefully early August.
Okay.
Cool.
I'll have to look out for that.
Then I'm not sure what Lox Productions want to do next. I think we might do Sewer Sharks as priority, kind of, because I already have music for it, and I like to have music in my audiobooks.
And all I was
going to bring that up. You recently released Sewer Sharks. Can you tell us a little bit more about what this book is about?
Oh, it's my shittiest book yet.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
That means it's going to be a number one bestseller.
Yeah.
It's lovingly referred to during production as Graboid Hemorrhoids.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
We love we love the Tremors reference here.
Yeah,
yeah, it's or Shitter Critters. It's inspired by early 2000s B movie CGI schlock, but taken a little bit seriously, like the way the initial Sharknado was kind of, it was a parody, but it wasn't like delving into the realms of just sheer silliness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And kind of inspired by a lot of like early 2000s cinema. There's like references to the Kevin Smith movies and a couple of other like Spring Breakers movies like that.
Okay, yeah.
Get peppered in. It's the story of a real sleazy little Floridian town called Skids Bay, where a marine biologist working at the aquarium trying to preserve an extremely rare species of shark thinks that the only way to make sure that they're ensure their survival is to do a little bit of illegal underground genetic modification. It turns them into hyper violent aggressive mutant, and of course they get out.
I love Dave, you know I love me a good creature feature.
Yeah.
And now all you need now is to get Michael Bain to narrate it, and then you got your Kyle Reese, and then the whole thing will be complete.
And the whole thing is just like a wacky Tarantino-esque idea, like cast of weirdos and strangers that ultimately cross paths and all come together in this story about three mutant killer sharks on the loose in the sewers.
You obviously are inspired by a lot of nostalgia, and it seems in your. We've already talked about Terminator and like old Kevin Smith movies. Do you put like hidden like 80s nostalgic Easter eggs in your stories too?
Yeah, there's. I mean, when I write something in a set time period, I try to absorb myself in the time period a little bit. So I'll like listening to music, watching like commercial reels on YouTube and stuff, just to get like the right feel of the time and the right little aesthetics. The book I'm writing, I just finished writing actually last week. It's another 90s set slasher. And I had a character in it who does Tybo. My partner was reading it. She was like, "That's such a blast." She remembers doing the tapes herself.
Yeah,
they made us do Tybo in middle school as part of physical education.
Yeah, I remember that.
I hated it.
And then my swim coach made us do Tybo in like the off season, stay in shape.
Oh, I hate it. I was like, can't we just play basketball or something, please?
Yeah, there's other ways to stay in shape, not this.
and I like this stuff where I don't really mark the passage of time myself by like dates on a calendar and whatever. It's usually what movie came out or what movie or what video game or something. So a lot of the time that I have characters who I like place it on a time period and place in time by what video games they're playing or looking forward to, or what movies they're playing at the cinema and things like that. Like in like the Virgin Night, my first book I wrote that was set in the 90s, there's a point where a character stops to catch their breath between two posters on the wall, and one of them's Deep Impact. So like it tells you when and where it takes place.
That must be fun to just kind of go through and add those little things and then just sit back and go, well, I think I am officially all 90s.
Yeah. And then sometimes you make a dumbass mistake and you leave something that shouldn't be there.
And I'm sure that you'll probably be the only one that notices it.
Yeah.
Oh no, one person noticed one thing in Cotton Candy Massacre that didn't exist and it wasn't widespread in the 80s, and they made it a thing.
I guess you would hope that you would have diehard fans that would study your work so much to the point where they would go, excuse me, but Battletoads didn't come out until 19 or something like that.
2 years later after the book.
Yeah, 2 years later after this stuff happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, so sometimes I could paint myself into a corner. Like, there's a song that I wanted to use in this slasher book that doesn't even have a title yet. It's weird for me not to have a title when I write a book. But I wanted to use a song because it's a cover of a song from the 90s, but the cover wasn't actually done to 2003 or something.
Yeah.
So I'm like, fuck.
I love but the idea.
I figured out a way to make it work.
I love the idea of you writing like explicit stuff, and the person reading, the only thing that disturbs them is the fact that you got that detail wrong.
Yeah.
Go on, Dave.
But also, with all the books you put out, you also found time to write a short story that is going to be in The Doors of Darkness Trick or Treat 2, I believe.
Doors of Darkness 2 Trick or Treat, yeah. Yeah, I don't really do a lot of short stories anymore. I don't really have the skill for it. Because everything I write tends to go on and on and on and on. Famously, like I was saying to my partner when I was writing Cotton Candy Massacre, I'm pretty sure this will be about as length of Zombie Sweetheart. It's not going to be that long. It's probably a novella. And it's, it's 30,000 words, and I'm not quite at the part where I want to let the chaos happen yet. Like, I still want to keep building up. I want to make people wait a little bit longer.
Just a few more pages.
Yeah.
I'm the length of an average book. and we're still not at the horror element yet, the carnage yet. And I'm like, yeah, now it's time.
Yeah.
Well, how long does it have to be for it to be before it goes from short story to I just might as well make this into a book?
Yeah. So there's different publishers and different publications and different genres will have different rules.
Yeah.
But typically, a lot of, especially in the indie sphere with short story collections, they tend to cap out about 5,000 words for a short story.
Okay.
Some of the other short stories I've have published are way, way longer than that. Like the one I had published in a book called The Sacrament was actually technically a novel at length, but they just let it in anyway.
Just give it to him.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have expected to get asked to cut a lot of content from it to trim it down, but they didn't.
Nice of them.
Yeah. But what's like the process of like submitting a short story for an anthology?
So they're different depending on publishers. And I don't do it that often, but I would say that TerraCore Publishing, Caleb, the guy that runs, that publishes the Doors of Darkness books, that was like one of the smoothest I've ever like seen for like how professional it is. It's done by a Google form. You fill in your details and you link the Google file of your document. So there's like no stuff getting like lost in email and lost in inboxes.
Yeah.
Which is a great way to do things. That whole thing's been very meticulously organized. Like, I don't know how much he would be okay with me saying about how the inner workings of it, but when it's an anthology that takes place in the same street, and there's 24 different stories in it, he's got a really robust system for allowing like people and other writers to reference each other and keep track of what is and isn't. I mean, there likely will be inconsistencies, but that's because, you know, whenever someone's telling a story as well, it's their point of view, it's their story they're telling.
Yeah.
Their interpretation of the world could be a little bit different from their neighbor.
I do like stories where you get the same thing told from different perspectives.
Yeah. So like I worked with, there's a couple of the other authors in that story, and we like left notes for each other for just how to reference things. So like my story in that anthology centers around a young guy, probably 18, 19, called Parker, who is very ill, and he lives in his basement of his mother's house. He plays like classic, like point and click type adventure games all night long, like late 80s. As part of the setup for it, in the backstory before my story begins, his mother and father had a very disharmonious breakup, and one of the other authors asked if, because his story takes place the year before mine, he included comments about the parents of that house always fighting, and their neighbor always fighting and screaming matches in the middle of the night. So this is a little way to sort of like blend the stories into the same world.
That's pretty awesome. I can't wait to check that one out.
Yeah, I think it was rare that I do a short story, but when I saw this call for it and I had a really, really solid idea that I wanted to do, it was actually a rejected October Society idea because it ended up being far too adult for October Society.
Well, I'm glad I found a home somewhere.
Yeah.
So I wrote it for this, and I managed to keep the word count under 5,000 on my first draft as well, which is really weird for me.
Yeah, sometimes just things work out.
Yeah.
Usually my trick for keeping my word count down is if I write in first person. So if I Laser Lizards is my shortest story because it isn't told entirely from the perspective of one character.
Yeah.
Like if I was writing that, like I write my other books, then I would have every other character's perspective and it would be a 60,000 word novel.
Well, I only got like maybe one general question left before we delve into Perfect Blue. So, Dave, do you have anything like?
I have a question that leads into Perfect Blue, so you can go ahead and ask your question.
Oh, okay, I'll just add, this is just a general question for. Do you have a quote unquote process when it comes to your? Do you have like, I don't know, maybe like a ritual of some kind that you do before going into read? I know, you know. Do you have to have like a setting just right or anything of that nature whenever you start going into your writing process?
So when I've got an idea for a book, so I'll have like a couple of ideas that are floating around in the back of my head, but they're not quite ready to come out yet, or they're not quite ready to demand attention. One good example is from the day I started writing like Zombie Sweetheart, I wanted to write a story about killer insects.
Yeah.
And it's been bubbling a little bit. I didn't quite know what I would do with it, where to do with it. Then I wrote Sewer Sharks, and I thought, well, I'm doing this like mid-2000s era, and I hate that the mid-2000s are now nostalgic, but there we go.
I didn't need to know that. I didn't need to be reminded about that.
Yeah.
Oh, I could do the horrible thing and tell you that we're now further away from Back to the Future than Back to the Future was from 1950s.
Yeah, I read that. Yeah. And you can also, like, those, you know, assholes who say, like, oh, you were born in the late 1900s. Yeah.
Thanks for that. Yeah.
So the idea would percolate in the back of my head. And once I finished Sewer Sharks, I was like, one of the characters in Sewer Sharks, for instance, is a young shark nerd intern called Callie. She is hands down the cutest character I've ever written. I don't think I've had as much fun writing someone as goofy, silly, and funny as her. Just a little bit of inside information. Pretty much all her accident-prone moments were inspired by and directly stolen from my own partner, Casey, who is incredibly accident-prone, and she's going to be so mortified right now.
It's going to make it even harder when you have to kill her off.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, Casey said she won't be listening to this episode because she's not actually seen Perfect Blue yet, and she wants to watch it before, so we're going to watch it, like, next month.
Oh, okay.
So yeah. She's going to listen to this later, so it's kind of like a great little Easter egg. Grenade.
Surprise!
Come back to bite me on the ass later. Oh, and yeah, by the way, dolphins are better than sharks. That will really get her annoyed.
Oh, well, I mean, that's just a fact, though.
Yeah, and piranha are even better. Like, come on.
Yeah, I mean, we're just talking facts here on the show.
Yeah.
She's gonna kill us all.
Just to find me first.
Yeah.
No, she's really good at that, don't worry.
It's going to be like Taken. I'm going to open up the door and you're like, I told you I'd find you.
Oh, no, Casey, I love these. Don't murder me in my sleep.
We'll know when we read the headlines in a couple of weeks.
You won't find my body. I'll be lost in all her stuffies. She's got like a life-size Gengar that's bigger than me.
Weirdly enough, I'm sure that you'll respect it. Yeah. You know, that's why she's my partner. They'll never find the body.
Yeah.
So I wanted to do the bugs, and I thought Callie as a character is just coming off a horrible breakup, and I was like, what if I do the bug story as a simultaneous movie, giant killer bugs in another town, and I follow her ex and see what's happened, like what her side of the story was and why she ended things with Callie, and kind of do like a Pokemon Red Blue type thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Where it's their companions, they're not really sequels, although there's a wraparound to the bugs that has characters that make it through the first book, and then they're in at the ending, but the bulk of the bugs of the book, effed up bugs, is entirely standalone and takes place in tandem with the events of Sewer Sharks. With a little bit of references back and forth, like the sort of, for instance, the scientists in Sewer Sharks who mess around with the sharks, turn them into mutants. The stuff he gets, he uses, comes from the mad scientist that's in effed up bugs, so they're like called.
That's awesome, yeah.
It's all connected.
Yeah,
that I don't think I have the I don't know if I have the wherewithal to create like a expanded universe of like things that feed into each other. Like
all connect.
I just know that I would be, my place would just be a mess with just like lines.
Your Charlie Day notes.
Yes, my Charlie Day knows. Yeah. I'm talking to, I'm smoking, chain smoking cigarettes and talking to Pepe Sylvia, who doesn't live here. But Dave, I think you had a pretty good, you said you had a good question that leads us into our movie of the day.
Yeah, so you chose for us to review Perfect Blue. Is there any of your works that relate to Perfect Blue at all?
The book that I've been working on,
okay.
That I'm not ready to talk about or anything yet, is kind of like the most somber, serious slasher story I've written. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's much humor in it. I think I'm sure people will find some humor because I don't know if I can stop myself. But as the tone of it is far more. For instance, the other of my first '90s book, Virgin Night, the key song to that was "The Kids Aren't All Right" by The Offspring. Yeah. Key song to this one is "Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness."
Oh, cool. That's cool. Yeah, that makes sense, especially while watching Perfect, which, thank you for recommending this one. Now, I have to ask, did you recommend this to me sometime before? Because I saw this movie randomly like a year and some change ago as part of just I was just doing random Instagram movie reviews, and this one was just a randomly one of them.
I might have. I kind of felt really bad because last time I was on, I inflicted popcorn on you, and it made it onto your, which like bad movie deserves a remake thing, and I was like, oh, I've given them one of their. So I'll give you a good one this time. So next
popcorn
time,
popcorn isn't awful.
All bets are off.
It's not an awful movie, but It could be so much better than it was.
I love the setting of Popcorn. It's one of my favorite like horror movie settings. An old movie theater where everybody's like having fun watching old B movie kind of movies. That's right up my alley.
There was one, and there was a giallo inspired one fairly recently that I cannot remember the title of. I think I had it on my Instagram. I'll look it up at some point and remind you guys of it. That is a slasher set in a movie theater where people are killed off while they're watching the movie.
What, say that one more time.
So there was a slasher movie that is, I think it's Italian, or at least like Italian giallo inspired, that is about people that are killed off in a movie theater while they're watching the film. Arrow Video released it over here. I'm just trying to remember its name. I'll probably blurt it out randomly later on.
Out of curiosity, have you seen a movie called All About Evil?
Describe it, because it sounds familiar.
It was a movie I tried to get Dave into, because it was Popcorn-esque, where this girl inherits an old rundown movie theater, and then she kills people while recording it, kind of like making snuff films, and it gets shown on the screen, but people think it's just a indie movie. So she starts killing people, recording it, and displaying it on the movie theater. People just think it's just like this indie movie that she's putting on, but it's actually her killing people.
No, but I think I should.
All right. Well, Dave didn't like it, but I don't know. Maybe you might, since we're on the subject of movies.
Yeah.
And
yeah, this one's called The Last Matinee.
The Last Matinee.
Last Matinee.
Matinee. I'm so familiar.
Okay, there's probably only like a handful of like movies that like take place in the movie theater. So I just like that in general.
Yeah, like Demons is the gold standard.
But we're not talking about that, damn it. We're talking about Perfect Blue.
Are we?
Are we? I'm Perfect Blue / whatever the hell.
Yeah.
Well, that fits in with the themes of Perfect Blue perfectly, because
it's
a film that constantly blurs the line between what is actually real and what isn't, what's stage and what's fake.
I'm glad that I got it a second viewing, because I remember watching it the first time, and I think that I don't know, there's still parts of me that that whenever I review things probably like try to think, well, I have to be critical about certain things, but I don't know, I might have said it was a little slow last the first time I watched it, but I'm glad I watched it a second time, because it is I think I like it a lot better on the second viewing.
Yeah, I felt like it had a really good build up. Like you said, it's a kind of slow, but it's not too slow where it takes you out of the movie.
Yeah, there's a pivotal scene about that's exactly halfway. It's like meticulously halfway through the film. Like if you were to be watching the timing, that in particular kill scene is the exact middle of the movie, and it's when everything tips. When we go from just paranoia and psychological drama to outright slasher horror.
Yeah.
Well, for people, since we're just kind of talking vaguely about the movie, if you have never seen Perfect Blue, just a quick synopsis is that it's Japanese pop idol is moving into more serious acting business, and she begins getting stalked. She begins having hallucinations, and she quickly just spirals into like paranoia and hallucinations and whatnot. And I didn't know, apparently, being a pop idol in Japan doesn't pay nearly as much as I thought, I guess. Because I think one of the beginning lines is like, yeah, it makes sense that she's going into acting. Pop idols, not like pop idols make that much money or anything. I was like, really?
Yeah, I think we confuse the Japanese like pop idol with like a Western pop star, like someone like Taylor Swift or something.
Yeah.
But I think this is, what, 97?
Mm-hmm.
And now with how big J-pop and K-pop are in the Western world,
oh, yeah.
We assume now they're making, you know, pretty good chunk of change.
I was thinking that just had to be a Western thing, because when I heard pop idol, yeah, I was thinking, or if we're going to go retro, I was thinking like Britney Spears or something like that. Yeah,
I think really? Even for the 90s, you would have had big bands that were breakout stars and internationally recognized, but the idol scene was a little bit different.
Yeah.
Like, you would see stores that were just selling just like pictures of the idols and their CDs and stuff. There'd be hundreds of them active at any one time. They were treated more like, it was more like a commodity really than like celebrities. I guess they were minor celebrities because they would have followings and they would have fans, but
yeah,
it's such a self-contained and strange world of stardom. But yeah, like the, and the Wonder One is very brief as well. Like, it's touched on in the film. Like, one of the main character Mima's agents is a former pop idol herself, and how like quickly she was like aged and phased out of it as she grew older and she gained weight, because it's an extremely
rough industry.
Yeah,
it's a very rough industry. But you know, probably would have been better off for her to stay an idol.
Yeah.
So, Dave. So you said this was your first time seeing it, and I was talking to Dave. I think you might have ever heard when you heard us blaspheming, comparing it to Scooby-Doo on Zombie Island. But this kind of animation, I don't usually think horror, or I don't usually come across a lot of like horror in like anime, unless you're talking about like Coraline or something like that, horror-esque, or maybe as of recently, Mad God. But
yeah.
Are there any, personally, just I'm wondering, do you have any other like animated recommendations like this? I'm always looking to expand.
Yeah,
not straight up like this. I mean, everything in Satoshi Kon, the director's filmography, is worth seeing. He really was like a singular visionary. He's kind of like everything he's done has got this sort of like mature, dark streak to it. Even though it's things on the surface that appear quite nice or not. But there's a lot of horror adjacent and horror anime stuff I could recommend. Like, anime's been a big part of my life and a big part of like how I even learned to write stories to begin with. It's been part of me since I was very, very little. Which coincidentally, I think I saw this movie when I was like 8 or 7.
I don't think that at 8 or 7, I don't think I would have had the attention span for subtitles for 8 or 7. I think I would have just been turned off by having to read subtitles, in all honesty.
Yeah, I would have needed to have it dubbed at that age.
So horror, especially horror anime and manga in the 90s when Perfect Blue was released, wasn't really a thing, because it was very hard to convince publishers then to publish anything that would be straight up horror.
Yeah.
To the point where a contemporary of Satoshi Kon, who created a series called Vampire Hunter D, purposely set the gothic Dracula vampire hunting action. They purposely set the storyline and everything in the future, so they would be like cybernetic horses and cybernetic body parts, literally, so you could claim it as science fiction.
Ah, smart.
So that publishers would be like, you'd be a publisher like, no, it's not horror, it's science fiction. You know, look, there's robots and stuff.
Look, the blood isn't red, the blood is purple.
Yeah.
Or white if it's in China, which doesn't look right in a lot of cases.
Yeah. Plus, I imagine with the amount of time it takes to do like hand drawn stuff, you wouldn't want to, you'd be taking a gamble, because it takes a long time to do like hand drawn animation. And if it doesn't sell, then you're kind of out of luck.
Yeah, typically the pipeline now in Japan in anime is, if the manga is successful, it will be adapted. There's certain manga that you just know are going to take off, and the adaptation for them begins like either while it's still in publication or while it's still coming, it's still in its infancy.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there's a bit of a misfire with the popularity. Like Chainsaw Man's a very popular manga, but I don't think the anime hit quite as well. It didn't take off as much as they expected. I think there was like some controversy around the animation style. They made it look too westernized, which a lot of people weren't a fan of. I personally liked it. I thought it suited the
story.
The story is like more horror and more adult. Like it wouldn't have suited being super cartoonish. That said, there's plenty of anime that is very Japanese, but not super cartoony and silly, like something like Demon Slayer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, characters might look adorably cute on the surface, but that story is dark. It's got violent themes. It's got some very dark and heartbreaking moments. And then there's Attack on Titan, which is just the peak of anime storytelling. Everything about that is brutal and dark and depressing and so intricate and written in such a way that just gets me stunned in awe every time I look at it, to think of how well seeded every single plot twist and every future revelation was, right back to the very first episode.
Dave, this was your first time. I think this is not my first time, or Chris's. This is yours. What was your first impression of it, this being your first go around?
I mean, I really enjoyed this storyline.
Do you watch anime or anything?
I really don't watch a lot of anime, so I was actually pleasantly surprised how good this was. Because there's a lot of times this movie having going, just like, why is all this happening? Why? Oh, that's why it's happening. Because there are a lot of, like, twists in this story.
And it is interesting because it's definitely a psychological thriller.
Yeah.
And it might be the, like, it feels like you could have told this same story even in live action, which is cool too. Like anime is a lot of hard times it would be hard to do like anime turned live action, but this one, the story is very grounded, which I thought was pretty good.
Yeah, that's the thing that's fairly atypical for anime. It's kind of like, it's why it's a great recommendation for people who don't watch anime or haven't watched anime, but also a bad one because you're not going to find a lot along the lines of this. Maybe something like King of the Pigs, mm-hmm, or something that's like got a similar grounded realistic tone to it.
I think that's why I thought it was interesting as I was watching it, just because when you think anime, when I think anime, I think there's some sort of, I'm not used to watching a slower paced grounded anime is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And this was a quite a nice surprise, especially like I said, having just went and saw, the last one I saw before this was Princess Mononoke over at the movie theater. So that is a very, very fantastical kind of story of talking animals and gods and all sorts of out there things. And then this one, very opposite, a lot more quiet, a lot.
Anime is such a broad style and a broad genre that there are pockets in it of more realistic, grounded stories.
Yeah.
Like one series that I love a great deal is called Hajime no Ippo, The Fighting, and it's a very down-to-earth story of a young bullied boy who discovers boxing, and it changes his career. He becomes like rookie of the year champion, follows his like professional boxing career through his defeats and his victories, building up like through a considerable number of episodes to a penultimate like fight with who was essentially his like friend and rival from early on in the series. It features like a lot of attention to detail to real boxing, to real boxing techniques and stances, and the science and the physics behind it, and the emotional side of it, and his things like he's like dealing with defeat, dealing with the ramifications of injuries and what implications might have for his future. And none of it's fantastical, none of it's ridiculous. Like the probably only part of it that's probably more a little bit over the top is where one of the more experienced boxers gets in a fight with a bear in the woods and wins. But nobody believes it happened to him, which is the really funny thing. It's like, because it's so ridiculous it couldn't have happened, and no one believes it at first.
Sorry, I was looking up this since we were talking about serious like animation. It was gonna bug me if I didn't at least shout out this. I believe it's a South Korean anime called A Silent Voice. Also a grounded serious anime. I'd have been remiss if I didn't at least throw that out there. We can continue now.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of grounded serious animes, what about Pokemon? Super grounded.
I wasn't really much into Pokemon in all honesty growing up.
Oh, it's the only anime I've watched. And I'm still a fan of this day, so.
I don't know. You can't. There's something to be said for a show that puts you through 20 years worth of story to finally get to the satisfying conclusion you wanted from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Like that's one anime is often such a long form storytelling genre that when you get to the big epic moments, they have such weight to them because you've been waiting years and years and years.
Yeah. You know, I also remember starting to watch One Piece as a kid, and I hear that's still going.
It is. It's nearing its end, though. That'll be a day. For me, I was introduced to more adult anime before I was introduced to the more like accessible stuff.
Yeah, you were watching this at 8 years old.
Oh, I watched way worse than Perfect Blue at 8 years old.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure.
Yeah. My mom just liked to indulge my interest, so she would go to the local like rental store and just rent any anime films that she saw. So my very first series that I fell in love with was one called The Giver. It's like a science fiction series about this. I think you might have maybe seen or been aware of the Western adaptations. They did two movies, one with Mark Hamill. It's about a guy who finds this alien device that wraps onto his body, and he becomes like the cybernetic warrior. And there's like,
I was like Blue Beetle.
An evil corporation that's turned that gives people the ability to turn into monsters, and some stuff to do with like alien overlords and stuff. It gets very crazy. They did two Western movies based on it. Guyver Dark Hero. But I fell in love with the original, like, 12-part mini series, or OVA, as they were called, like, original video anime. And I remember renting all of them, and then she just rent whatever one. So that's how Perfect Blue came home one day. And then, much to her disgust and horror, a little film called Legend of the Overfiend, which is generally considered one of the earliest forms of hentai, you know, porn.
What was it called again?
Legend of the Overfiend. Legend of the Overfiend.
Of the Over.
Just writing that down.
Just writing that down.
Yeah. Quick. Don't quote me, but I think it might be the first use of tentacles.
Oh, I'll do my research.
So. Yeah. It's you know, you got to respect the history of the genre. You know,
we're all about getting the facts straight here.
Yeah. You're diving in, getting all the tentacles.
But that actually, you know, as funny as that is what make this is why I don't like seeing anime adapted into live action. I mean, I haven't seen the One Piece live action, so people seem to like it, but I think there's so much more you can do in animation that you can't really capture in live action.
Yeah.
Which I feel the same way with like Disney with live action like that, is that I love animation as a medium for storytelling, just because you can make faces more expressive, you can have fantastical things happen, and it makes sense within that world.
Yeah, and in live action you can't do the inner monologues that are common in anime.
Yeah.
So like a single, maybe only a couple of seconds pass in the real time, but you get inner monologues from multiple characters at the same time. So you understand what's behind the blows and what's behind the thought of their fight or what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could have a whole episode just on just the person thinking of what they're about to do next, and then next time.
nothing taught me patience like Goku have his hands above his head summoning the spirit bomb for 20 episodes.
Yeah.
Next time on Dragon Ball Z, we'll see what Frieza thinks about this.
Yeah.
Something about monkeys.
Yeah.
And so that's... I had a follow-up to that, but now I'm all I can think about is Goku now.
That's as you should. He died for our sins.
He died for our sins, and you know, that's why I think all of us 30, 40-something-year-olds feel tired as we do now, because we all had to give up a piece of our energy for him to make that spirit bomb.
Yeah.
More than once as well. Like, he kept asking for it. Like,
so, I mean, that's why I'm tired all the time.
Yeah.
And he was back at it again in the Tournament of Power, although he didn't take that much. That time.
He took it on a weekend where I was resting anyway.
Yeah. And that was in another universe, so maybe he bothered other people. Or in the space between universes, so I think we were left.
Yeah. I think I stopped watching after Dragon Ball GT, I think.
So super retcons that and goes in a different direction.
That's what I was going to say. I honestly think that's the direction that entertainment is going nowadays, though. I think we're slowly starting to move away from superhero movies, and I think we're now going to be diving into a lot more anime live action.
I think video games would be the next big.
Yeah.
Video games, but I also think anime along with it. I think those two are going to be the next big geekdom fan thing that's going to be happening.
I think video games adaptation still have that stigma from the early 2000s where...
It's getting better.
They got it wrong every time.
Yeah, so did superhero movies for a long time, though. And then it just took Iron Man. And you still had your Tim Burton Batman movies and stuff that were kind of bucking the trend. But
yeah,
I think like Mario Brothers movie was kind of foot in the door saying, you know, we can do video game movies and we can do them right. And we can do them so that they please everyone, fans and non-fans alike.
Yeah.
I think, I think that people are starting to realize that, too. I think, what was the last one? It was either Borderlands or Fallout, but...
So, Borderlands not out yet. Fallout was a good example of how it can be done, and it's an original story set in the Fallout universe.
Yeah.
That, to be honest, that's probably the best way to go for some things, like, I think...
Yeah, I can see video game adaptations being more series instead of, movies.
Oh, with, Last of Us.
Yeah. Story, yeah.
Yeah, so The Last of Us, Mario, and Fallout that are all been good examples of it being done well. I think, especially with superhero stuff, it comes down to can you respect the source material while still making it original and entertaining?
Yeah.
And you get, the Halo show, for instance, where the actor in it's, refusing to keep the Master Chief helmet on and wants to show his face in every scene. It's like, no, it's not Master Chief.
Yeah.
You're putting yourself before the character, so that shows a lack of interest or lack of understanding.
A lot of times you have a character like that, so you can kind of imagine it could be anybody.
Yeah, like Henry Cavill quitting The Witcher because they wouldn't stay true to the source material.
Yeah, I heard, like, which is funny because that was a bummer because when I think Henry Cavill, I picture him more as Geralt than I do Superman.
Yeah.
But maybe it is because he was a fan of video games too, so he was. I mean, probably very. So I'm sure some days were a very easy paycheck where he just has to look at the camera and just go, fuck.
Yeah.
Well, he got made fun of for going on set with copies of books that were annotated. That's the wrong amount. That's the wrong attitude to have on a set.
Yeah.
Someone's showing up as work and it's not even their job, but they're paying attention and they've got ideas and they've got notes. It's like, no, they care.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to take on board everything he says, but he clearly cares.
I love that he's a nerd. I know he's always pushing Warhammer, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Never played Warhammer, but it looks fun.
You know, I'm completely happy with this just turning into just anime talk in general.
Video games,
just video games and whatnot. I'm fine with this.
Well, I mean, it's so hard to talk about a movie like Perfect Blue without absolutely ruining the.
Oh, I know. That's what I'm saying. That's why at one point I said I tried to bring it back to Perfect Blue, but then it's just a natural thing. It's why this thing is fun. We did the same thing with Tag back in the day when we had Tag. We start off talking about Alien.
And then we just went all over science fiction. But I mean, Perfect Blue is a great movie. If you guys are listening, let's just go check it out. It's available on Shudder here in the US.
For free. Yeah, it's on. Yeah, it's free on Shudder.
Yeah, it's sadly not streaming anywhere in the UK. Like, you can't even buy it on a digital platform.
Well, how's your partner going to watch it then?
Because I'm going to have to bring it to her.
Oh. So, well, we'll dedicate this episode to them just so we, like, see, we made a whole non-spoilery episode just because we want this all to be a surprise.
And I did all my goddamn research on it as well. Like, I've got so many notes here. I'll just read them out so it's like we did a job.
Right.
Okay.
Like, I love the scene where she's learning how to use a computer. Because up till that point, you kind of forget that it takes place in 97. If you're just like, wait, what?
It's very reminiscent of trying to teach
people
your
parents didn't have back computers then.
I'm currently watching it right now, and she's using a landline, which is taking me back.
So, as back what we were saying earlier, though, it's like, it is like a really realistic portrayal, but of an animated world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that kind of itself is kind of like represents the split between fantasy and reality that just runs through the whole film.
Yeah.
Like, what begins as completely realistic is something that, like, completely fractures. And, like, by the time she's starting to think, am I crazy? We're starting to think, are we crazy? Or what are we watching? And they mess with you all the time with constantly faking out what you're seeing. Like, you think you're watching a scene of her regular life, and no, it's a shot from the TV show she's on.
Yeah, like, her getting sexually assaulted in the club. I was like, wait, did I miss something? And then they're like, cut. I was like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you're like, oh, like, that's not that. But then you're like, oh, that's even worse because she's there all day. And, like, even the guy that's filming the scenes being polite to her. But
he said, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And it's like,
that would be me.
Like, I'm sorry. Are you okay? You okay?
Yeah. I was thinking, like, that alone would probably kind of mess somebody up just mentally. If I was like, I went home and I had to do this, you know, this rape scene all day. I had strangers tugging at my breasts and all this business. And even if it's fake, I could, you know.
And it's really around that time where we start to see the complete break in her mental flame. Like, she starts to see the other version of herself, the one that stayed with Cham, like her pop group.
It's hard to do psychological. We've done a couple other psychological thrillers. I think Jacob's Ladder was the last one we posted when we did our verses. And it's psychological horror's got to be kind of hard because you have to insert a sense of, like, nonsense. But still have it make sense within the story itself. You know what I mean? Like, you have to, you would have to put these nonsensical reactions, but not come off as just like, I'm just throwing things out there just to throw things out there, just to be confusing.
So there is a visual trick to the film that tells you how much of what's going on is real and how much of it's hallucinatory. And it's to do with the amount of red on the screen at that time and place.
Did you notice that, or did you have to or did you read up on it?
I think I noticed it originally when I was because I've watched this film as a kid, and I did stuff on it when I was like a film student.
Oh.
And I was talking about it, writing like an essays and stuff on it back then, like psychological horror. And just the bit that made that kind of obvious to me, or like stood out to me, is during the like sort of finale conflict scene where she's running and the railings on either side of her are red, because the railings wouldn't normally be red unless it's a video game and they're telling you where to go. And it's kind of like, oh, like it's like kind of like she's running a path between like this, all this craziness that's going on. There's one other scene earlier where someone talks to her after she's had like a something, I don't want to say what it is, but something's happened, and the lighting on the wall is very, very red, and then when she starts to calm down, the lighting is more subdued.
That's probably really good. I love when you watch a movie and then you notice something like that, and then you go, you make yourself feel like, I am one smart motherfucker. Like, I bet nobody else saw that.
Well, I think you go through phases as like a film watcher, or like a film appreciator, or whatever term you want to use. Because when I was younger, I was all about the deeper meaning and the themes and understanding and interpreting things. And then sort of like maybe late 20s onwards, I was more, there's like merit to be had from this popcorn blockbuster thing. No, there's important themes. And now I'm like, hey, big shark, go bite. Yes, awesome.
big shark, make big mess.
Yeah. Love it.
Yeah, I think I just stopped caring.
I still like that feeling though. It comes naturally, and it's like you just go, "Oh,
yeah." But I also enjoy just being able to turn my mind off for a little bit and just enjoy fun nonsense for a while.
But well, it's still on a subject, a slightly different anime. Something like Attack on Titan has that constant thing where it's constantly pulling the wool over your eyes, and there's revelations that make you realize, why the hell didn't I question that earlier?
Yeah.
Like, all right, maybe I need to get into it.
It was all there in plain sight. There's a great meme for Attack on Titan that says, first season, I know where this is going. The next three seasons, lol, no, I fucking don't.
I know nothing. All right, that's on my list. There's so many good animes out there that I have I keep saying are going to be on my list. Attack on Titan is one of them.
Yeah,
and that's because it's contained. You've got the entire thing is done. You're not waiting for any more content. As a Demon Slayer fan, I'm like, so they're going to do three movies for the Infinity Castle storyline. So that's three more years of waiting, and then it'll be a year after that before the series the thing ends with the Sunrise storyline. And it's like, okay, so I've got to make it through to 2028, I guess.
Yeah, sometimes I consider subscribing to, was it Crunchyroll? It's an anime service out here.
Yeah, I've got that here. You get a lot on there. It's good. I will say that a lot of what's popular in anime, especially things like Crunchyroll, they kind of like give the impression of what most people would expect from anime. The silliness, the goofiness, the fan service, the over-the-top action, screaming, the shouting. Where there's a lot of anime that's like something like Cowboy Bebop, I guess, still going back to the 90s. There are shows. Yeah. Or dark, like sci-fi shows like Neon Genesis or Elfin Lied.
Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah. Like, again, I keep going back to the 90s type stuff.
Go for it, man.
And then you've got, like, there is a new adaptation of Junji Ito's Uzumaki, like an animated one in production.
Mm-hmm.
Junji Ito's stuff's famously very difficult to make live action or film. Like, Netflix tried it with an animated series that they tried, but you can't really capture the sheer insanity of Junji Ito's artwork in live action or animation.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see how this Uzumaki adaptation is going to be, because there's been a live action Uzumaki film that was good in its own right, but it's not the manga that it's based on. And
random question. We know my thoughts of anime to live action. Is there anything that is a regular movie that you think would have been better told as an anime or animation?
Well, we can see that happening at the moment, because the Suicide Squad has been made into an anime.
Really?
Yeah, so Suicide Squad Iseki. And Iseki is a genre of anime where people get put into an anime world. So in this case, the actual Suicide Squad get whatever happens to them, and they wake up in an anime world where suddenly they've now got, like, their powers are now animeified.
I think they made Clayface like a badass in that show.
Yeah, so again, that's not actually anywhere I can watch over here, but I'd want to see it. I really want to see it. It looks fun.
They've been doing that a couple of times. They did that with They did a Batman Joker anime thing too, where there was like in the old samurai era, and Batman was like had like samurai armor or something like that.
The Batman Ninja.
Yeah.
That was weird because it was like different animators doing different things, and it changed around a lot.
I thought it looked pretty cool.
Yeah, well, I feel like there is another attempt at that happening, another Batman anime.
They're doing something now where it's like a whole different thing where I forget what it's called, but Batman is jacked and he doesn't have any money, and like he's bigger than Superman in terms of like stature, and Wonder Woman has like tribal war paint, and all that business. Yeah, I know which one you're talking about. It looks pretty cool.
And there was also, I've not seen it, but I would like to track it down and watch it, a anime adaptation of Supernatural.
Oh, that's you, Dave.
Oh, I haven't seen the anime version, but I'm actually currently rewatching Supernatural. I think that would be really good, though.
I still haven't, like, brought myself to try to get into that show. I don't know why. It feels like it would be a match made in heaven for me, but I don't know why. I can't get... It's the first season, I think. I don't know. It just felt very rinse, lather, repeat. By the time I got to like episode 6,
I kind of was like a monster of the week road trip until halfway through season 2, really, when
they start doing the overlaying storylines of Yellow Eye Demon and then the Apocalypse.
I might just have to go back and just try it again because I want to be part of the fandom, because everybody, you know, especially when it gets into the later ones where they start doing fun, more kind of like fun episodes.
There's fun ones from earlier on, like when there's one where it's like they keep going through different genres of TV show.
Oh, well, I guess I just need to get past episode 5.
Yeah, that's in season 5. That
episode. One where they get taken into our world.
Yeah,
so they're on the production of Supernatural.
They go to Scooby Doo one episode?
Yeah, that's in the later seasons. I'll say season 11 or 12.
I need to get up to that point, so maybe I just need to, you know.
I did find with that show the later seasons, I was missing the Monster of the Week, just standalone episodes more, because every episode was leading into something bigger and bigger and bigger.
I'm just being too harsh on it. It's been a little bit of time. Maybe I just need to go back and rewatch it. I do like a Monster of a Week.
Yeah.
I think the last one I watched was when they were fighting the Wendigo.
That's the second episode.
Yeah, that's episode 2.
It was either that or there was some kind of bugs or worms under the ground. It was like episode 3 or 4. I didn't get very far, so I guess I can't really say it all felt the same. I've only watched 3 episodes, and it feels all the same.
Yeah.
There is also a Terminator anime series coming to Netflix, Terminator Zero. So you can imagine how much I want to see that.
Yeah, I heard about that one.
It always comes back to Terminator.
Terminator will be really good as anime, yeah.
I was, in all honesty, when we were saying that out loud, I was thinking, you know, Terminator would probably look pretty badass as animated.
Right. So you don't have to worry about CGI or practical effects. You could just do whatever the hell you want with them.
And yeah, as a form of visual storytelling, I think it's really hard to surpass the stuff that anime can do. I mean, it's something that I think probably had a huge effect on the way I like to tell stories, because I don't often explain, I show. Like, I'm on the scale of tell versus show as a writer, I'm like 90 to 95% show.
Yeah.
Rather than tell. And a lot of the ways I do that is just through little visual cues and stuff like that. Or like, you know, rather than like just talking about how a person's mental state is and telling you all the things that's been going through them, stuff like that, I'll just have the way their room is a certain way, or talk, or like have them not change clothes for a couple of days or something like that to indicate that they're in a sort of depressive loop.
Yeah.
I like attention to detail like that, like where you don't have to, when you show and don't tell, you pretty much just tell your audience, like, I don't have to hold your hand. You guys can, you guys can put 2 and 2 together.
It's also like in things like Perfect Blue, like one of the really good examples of just the visual storytelling is the stuff with the fish tank.
Oh, yeah.
So after Mima's scene in the nightclub, the stage drape scene, she comes back and has a moment where she finally breaks down. She's crying, and then like her fish are dead.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We had already seen that she's forgetting to feed her fish.
Yeah.
But then there's a moment where the fish are fine. After when she recovers, I might be mixing scenes up at this point. But if you really squarely pay attention, you'll notice that there's less and less fish in our fish tank over time.
Yeah.
And that has a payoff at the end with the Mima's room scene.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one that told me. Like, I was like, oh, she's not where she thinks she is.
It's an unreliable narrator.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the implication that the person responsible for the stalking of right. her is yeah. far more insidious, and is essentially the implication is that not only have they been in her apartment from early on, they can come and go as they please.
Yeah.
And they have been coming and going as they please since early on.
Yeah. I like it. I like things where it's like, is this legitimate or is she just being crazy? Like, yeah. Or is there some legitimacy to her? Like, she's not going crazy, but somebody wants her to think she's going crazy.
Yeah.
There's something I've read that I find it difficult to notice myself because I don't really have an ear for it. But people have said that the voice of her at the end, where she proclaims, "I'm me.
I'm the real Mima."
Yeah, it's not the actual Mima voice actress who says it.
That would have a cool implication if that's the case.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one I'm not 100% on, because I find it hard to distinguish the voices.
Yeah.
Especially when there's so many in my head laughing, doing the clown voices all the time.
everybody sounds like Pennywise.
Yeah. So there's stuff I do in my books that I definitely get ideas from anime, from just doing that little bit of storytelling. Like, so back to one of my favorite examples, it's not perfect, yeah. but it's Attack on Titan, and the character of Eren Yeager. He's a tremendous character development. Without spoiling anything, he goes so far from where he is in episode one to the final episode that it is spectacular. And a lot of his state of mind and personality is depicted through just the way he looks and dresses. And early on, he's got sort of boyish and bouncy anime hair. In later seasons, he's got sort of long, lank, almost unwashed hair hanging in front of his face. And then towards the very end, that hair is mostly tied back and neatly arranged. And you could interpret that as he's wide-eyed, he's innocent. When it's in the lank, like, hanging phase, yeah. he's entering something he doesn't like, or he's dealing with something he's not ready to accept. And by the time he takes it and ties it back, he's finally accepted what has to happen and what he is and what the path forward is. And it's a maturing and sobering stuff. And I'm nowhere near that level of gifted when it comes to storytelling. But I do a similar thing in the Cotton Candy series with the character of Lee and her hair.
Okay.
So in the first Cotton Candy, her hair is just badly dyed, mess. She's not really taking care of it too much.
And yeah.
Second Cotton Candy, she's dyed her hair blue, which is indicative of her survivor's guilt and her depressive state.
Yeah.
Like, there's one of the lines that I had in my head when I first started, when I visualized her, what she would look like and what she'd be like in the second book. And I had her reunion with a certain character, and she'd be like, "Lee, you're blue," pointing to her hair. And she's like, "Yeah, new hair, same bitch." Like, and
that's got to be cool seeing your characters like grow over the over the course of time.
And I will continue it when we eventually people see Lee again. Not in a third Cotton Candy book. I think I have to be upfront about that. Is people expect or have wanted to know if the third Cotton Candy book will show what's going to happen with Lee and the other characters who've made it out. And there just isn't a place for them in this particular story. It's someone else's story, but the series isn't over. This is just
build a little tension.
Yeah.
I would say, an 80 to 90% standalone story that spirals the events from previous books out into the bigger world.
Okay.
And, bring everything that's sort of been simmering together. Like, it is planned as a quadrilogy of stories. And
is it a buffer to get from like 2 to 4?
If anything, this was originally what I had in mind for the proper full-on sequel, and part 2 began life as sort of maybe like a novella, a tie-in, bridging the gap. But there's just too much story to tell.
That
it couldn't just be in like a little standalone novella, and there was even like a lot of content from it that. Like, you know, like one of the parts of part 2 is that the character, the clown in it, has 3 very colorful, crazy clown dogs that help her in her like little shenanigans that she gets up to. I had written or penciled out like rough drafts of several flashback scenes that show how she met these dogs and it added like a lot more gruesome kills and stuff to the story. But then when I was putting it together, and I was like, I don't like the constantly leaving the scene, the setting, because the sort of vibe and inspiration I wanted for the part toots was more like Saw. Like, it was a isolated, singular location, make the most out of it, and a lot of like nasty games to play. And the story was just, if I kept jumping away every couple of chapters to another flashback, I just felt like I was taken away from what was going on there. And I do it once, kind of, in the book, where a character tells a story, but he's telling it directly to another person. So it's like, it's still within the confines of the Fun Castle. Like, I never wanted to leave the venue.
That's cool, because standalone stories also are pretty cool when you have like just a world that you can just build on.
Yeah.
So what the Cotton Candy Massacre Part Treats was like would originally been that what I'd envisioned when I was still writing the first book. I was like, okay, if I do a second book, this is the setting and this is where it's going to be. So all those ideas just kind of got shelved and eventually become what's essentially the third book, that in terms of scale and like length is probably the same size as the first one, just because the setting is huge, it's a bigger cast of characters, there's a lot of moving parts, and it's not so much a buffer, but it doesn't concern the good guys. So it doesn't concern like Lee and anyone else. I don't want to spoil who else. And
that's okay. You can be vague. Yeah.
It doesn't concern Lee and the other survivors at the moment, but it will very much concern them down the road.
And just dot, dot, dot. Yeah. You'll have to wait and see what happens.
Yeah.
So there's a character that was introduced in part two, who was I had always had in mind as the sort of key antagonist / protagonist of the third book. Like, she's essentially Lee without, I won't even say the goodness, because Lee's a complex, like a morally complex character that's done a couple of shady things herself, but there's a lot of like honest reasons why she is, and she's not malevolent. And even again, this character, the villain of Part Treats, isn't malevolent either. What she's doing, what she wants to do, she's doing out of absolute love. It's just a very dark and twisted love.
Okay. Yeah.
But if you read Part Toots, you'll know who she is. And why she's a certain.
There's people out there listening right now. You know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
you know why she's very angry.
I always enjoy that when you have like an antagonist that you see why they're doing it. You're like, what you're doing makes sense to me. You're not doing it just because you're a terrible person or anything. You have a reason why.
Yeah, it's like a Negan type villain. Like,
yeah,
you come across as like, you initially meet them and you think they're like, well, I did it the opposite way around. When you initially meet this character, she is a good guy. She's a good friend and a good like counterpart like for Lee. She's like supportive. She's on Lee's side throughout the entire book of Part Toots.
Yeah.
And when it came to writing what happens and how that doesn't stay the case and everything, that was always the plan, that was always what I wanted to do. And that pain and that anger carries forth into her doing something very, 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 very tragic.
Yeah.
Okay, so essentially, Cotton Candy Massacre Part Treats takes place on Halloween night. The series is ticking inexorably closer to the end of the 80s. Yeah. Began in the summer of 1989. Part Toots took place in like late summer, early autumn of 1989. Now we're Halloween night. The series is counting down to the very, very end of the 1980s and the end of this era of splatter horror.
And into itself. The more tame 90s.
So Hannah, who was a character who was in Part Toots, was locked up in the Fun Castle with Lee, was revealed at the end of Part Toots to be the best friend of Sully, the clown from the first one. And discovers that Lee was responsible for killing Sully outright. Ooh. At the end.
Yeah.
In the heat of the moment and the pain of everything, she doesn't let it process that Lee didn't really have much of a choice.
Yeah,
she just is so consumed by her rage, but also by the stuff that she's found out about the sort of supernatural element that's in the backbone of Cotton Candy Massacre, the fact that Bonko the Clown almost came back from the dead, and that there is more to this world than makes sense. She believes she has a way to see her friend again if she can manifest as much chaos and as much suffering and as much blood spilled as the Bonkins Bonanza incident.
We'll make sure like to let you know when this will come out, so we don't
put that out there before. I think it's next week or something. I'm going to drop the plot synopsis, but
okay, then this should be fine then.
Yeah. So she is whether her goal works or not is completely up in the air, but
that's essentially the gist.
Yeah.
Essentially the gist. And hot off the events of the Cotton Candy Massacre, the Hardstack family, who Ruth was the ringleader, the person that reopened Bonkin Dancer, her family are desperately trying to, cover up the black eye that she's caused to their legacy by throwing and sponsoring a massive Halloween festival free of charge. Everyone come, everyone have a good time. All on us. Talk about how great and awesome we are. Don't talk about my crazy aunt and the killer clowns.
Yeah.
Don't ask questions, just have a good time.
Yeah, so there's a lot of people go to this town on this Halloween night, kind of a lot of people that wouldn't say no to a bit of free candy.
Yeah, yeah. And when is this supposed to be coming out?
Oh, I've not set an exact date yet, but it will be mid-October.
Okay.
Oh, just in time for Halloween time.
Yeah.
I like my seasonal releases and seasonal settings for my books.
Yeah.
It's the ultimate way to get into the season.
Yeah, like I've got a Christmas book that's coming out in December, If I wasn't able to get it out in December, I'd just wait till next year. I'd want it out. Although it does mean I end up working on these things out season. So I'm sitting listening to dark Christmas music in March.
Does that put any pressure on you? I have to get this done by Christmas.
I mean, it's pressure I put on myself, but I'll start it well ahead of time, knowing that I want to do it. Cotton Candy Massacre Part Treats, I started writing, I would say September of last year, but I'd already had most of the plot, 90% of the plot was already in my head. There wasn't much of a hold up when I started writing it. I knew exactly what I was doing, who the characters were, where it was going. Although I did do a little bit of randomness to it. There's a pivotal scene maybe towards the end of the first act where one key character dies, and I just did a Robert Kirkman and flipped a coin to decide who it was, and the plot spot in unfold from there. So I kind of had the big set pieces in head, and I knew that the antagonists were and what they were, but this particular character that lives or dies, this scene was a flip of the coin.
Okay.
Yeah. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, which one gets it essentially was a coin flip.
Yeah. Sometimes just leave it up to chance.
Yeah, I mean, that's where Robert Kirkman picked who dies in The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
I think when he rolled the die and it was Glenn's turn, he was like...
are gonna feel some kind of way about this.
Yeah, yeah. He's just blowing on the dice, hoping it moves.
Well, it's gonna be Glenn. Well, hopefully it'll be quick and painless.
No, so both of that and the last motherfucking Christmas, which is the Christmas. No, I'm gonna have to censor that title for Amazon and stuff. But
yeah, Amazon can just deal with it.
No, I'd like people to actually read it.
Yeah. No, just stand by it for better or worse.
So I think I'd started writing The Last Motherfucking Christmas one of the first books I started writing. It was a really weird thing. After I'd wrote Zombie Sweetheart, I went through a really painful breakup and an end of a very 17-year relationship. And I was a little bit of therapy. I was writing because it was right at Christmas as well. So I was writing a story, an 80s inspired action story of a guy who loses the person he loves on Christmas Eve. And it goes through it. Initially, the plan was to write a chapter every month, and it would be a year in the life of him trying to figure this out and stuff. But peppered in with crazy 80s action set pieces. The final book's not quite that. The final book ends up changing the idea and doing it. It takes place in the lead up to Christmas. And when I started writing it, I think I started writing it properly, redrafting it again late December, early January this year. But it was March when I was doing the final edits and tweaks on it and getting everything right. And it's just sitting listening to Christmas music to get in the mood in March was weird.
I can imagine.
You said that was that came on the heels of a breakup, is that what you said?
Yeah. That was a way of dealing with it.
I'd be too tempted to put my exit there and and then they lost their job and then just put all my frustrations out on that character.
I mean,
and then their house burned down. Then their house burned down and then they got fired.
Yeah.
I kinda did a little bit. it's not the characters in it aren't me and my X from that time.
And she knew she deserved it.
But the concept was, is so essentially The Last Motherfucking Christmas is a story of a guy called Joel who is about to propose to the woman he's been in love with for like the last 2 years. And she gets a strange call while they're at this snowy cabin in the woods. And she just walks out, ditches him, as if nothing ever happened. He's then quickly attacked by a bunch of masked men who tie him up, knock him out, and he wakes up in a bathtub with his chest ripped open and his heart gone.
That's a problem.
Yeah. It's also a problem. He's up and he's walking around and he's still alive.
Yeah.
He stumbles out of the bedroom to find Santa Claus sitting smoking a cigar, who proclaims that even though he's from the North Pole, this is the coldest shit he's ever seen. And he's going to grant Joel a bona fide Christmas miracle. Said if he can get his heart back by the Christmas dawn on Christmas Day, then he'll put it back in his chest and he'll be right as new and everything else. But he's
Santa, can't you just give me a heart?
No, he's got to do it himself. He's got to earn the Christmas miracle. So he goes on a 80s style action adventure saga that involves triads, underworld gangs, organ harvesting, and giant mega criminal organizations as he tracks down where the fuck his heart has gone, packed with like references to Jackie Chan movies and Die Hard and everything else I could cram in there.
That sounds like Jim being an thanks, awesome book.
Thanks, Santa. truly a Christmas miracle. You weren't the one who had to bloody your hands.
Yeah.
Who says Santa doesn't get his hands bloody later on in the book?
Oh, well, that would have just been my thought at the time. I would be like, well, Santa, do I really need a heart? I seem to be doing okay with it being ripped out.
Yeah. Oh, well, he does try that, and he's told, no, you'll drop dead on Christmas Day if you don't have it. Like, I couldn't, my Christmas magic only works up until Christmas Day, then you're fucked.
I love it. I mean, Santa, who's making these arbitrary rules? The author.
Yeah, there is a reason for it. There is an inward reason for it. There's a lot going on that's like not surface. That it does become very surface level, because it's like everything in it's Christmas themed. Like all the characters' names are bad Christmas puns. There's an elite military organization called the Candy Cane Corps.
Santa's personal army.
Well, they're not Santa's army. He doesn't quite have one anymore. There's been a coup in the North Pole.
Santa, has this happened before? Do you make this deal a lot? Like, you have rules and everything? How often do you come across people who have their hearts ripped open?
Yeah.
I've been around a long time, my boy. I've seen it all.
He was bored, really.
I had a similar story that at one point I was working on that kind of had a similar thing. Like, well, why is that? I was bored. I mean, I'm just like, who made these rules? Me, but I mean, I'm bored. I'll make whatever rules I want.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not a clever book. It's more commando than anything else.
It sounds like, have you guys ever seen Scrooged?
Yes.
It sounds like the television promo they were trying to do of the Santa of that was guns a-blazing, and his wife was ride or die too. Yeah. That movie that they were trying, that the main character was trying to push onto the studio. That's the movie it's making me think of.
Yeah, I mean, this Santa would be played by Dolph Lundgren.
Oh, of course, yeah. Only the best.
You know, it'd be like his ex would be like Sharon Stone. It would be Kurt Russell as Joel. It would be Dolph Lundgren as Santa.
he needs to give the speech from Blade Runner.
Danny DeVito was the voice of Rudolph.
I would definitely watch that.
Yeah, it's not. It's definitely not a family friend. I mean, Rudolph is a porn addiction in this book. So.
Well, now we have to hear the eventual audiobook for this.
Yeah.
Oh God. Yeah, that would be fun.
Yeah.
You might not be able to get Danny DeVito, but I'll play Rudolph. I'll play nearly free of charge. You know, I'm glad that we just kind of went into when it starts happening like organically, where it's like we talked about Perfect Blue, but then we talked about stuff like regarding Perfect Blue, but in other mediums, and then a little bit back to Perfect Blue and a little more about anime.
Yeah, I think off the title of this episode, not not about Perfect Blue or something, or or just make some meta statement about how, well, Perfect Blue is such a
I'll just title the
blends reality and fiction, and you don't quite know what you're listening to or watching to. And we tried to replicate that experience.
Just like the movie, we tended to jump around a lot.
Somewhat Perfect Blue.
I'll just call it, Perfect Blue is here too.
Yeah.
I know. I do feel bad because if there's one film that I would encourage, it would be on my top 10 films of all time list, and it's never going off that list, Perfect Blue is on there.
Well, I think we talked really plenty about
movie,
it.
Yeah.
I think we talked just enough about it to get people a little interested, but not enough that we like spoiled the ending or exactly what happens.
Yeah, you think about it, yeah.
Which is kind of what I want these, when we have guest interviews, I kind of want that to be the new thing where we can just talk about it like broadly and like other stuff that relates to it without giving away like the ending or the whole thing.
It was just the one thing about it that really does maybe to take away as a final thought on it is that for a movie that was made in, 1996, I think?
97, yeah.
It completely nails this concept of parasocial relationships that are so prevalent now. Like,
yeah.
If you take, for instance, ideas of, streamers or influencers who try and change up their style or their personality or what they're doing, mm-hmm. and they're just met with such, vitriol from the people who claim to love them, that they're not real people. They're the image of what you think you are. And you can do that to yourself. Like, I definitely do that to myself as a writer where I'm thinking, I have to write
a certain kind of way.
Yeah. B-movie, splatterpunk, silly stuff. And sometimes I get the urge to write something that's completely different. Like, I've had a steampunk fantasy idea kicking around in my head for a while, and it's just like, but that's not really me. And the people that want to read me, do they want to read something that's not got horny clowns fucking and swearing and Dolph Lundgren Santa Claus and mutant sharks? Like,
I imagine once you've kind of developed a fan base who sees your work a certain kind of way, I guess it does kind of make you scared to kind of take a chance to do something a little different.
Yeah.
Even when I announced The Last Motherfucking Christmas, people immediately assumed it's a horror story, and I'm like, okay, there's violence in it and there'll be some gore because it's 80s, but it's an action. It's in the back of my mind, it's Home Alone and Die Hard and Commando and The Last Action Hero.
Yeah.
There's no real horror to it. I mean, I guess there's no real horror to it. It's probably bits that people will think it's like extreme or whatever, and that's just the way things go. Like I said, I didn't think that this one book I was writing was funny, and yet I'm pretty sure people will find some humor in it.
I imagine
was that gross.
Yeah.
I imagine, if that's the kind you get used to a certain kind of way you write, that I imagine that will just kind of slip in there just unconsciously.
Yeah.
And it'll just seem tame to you. Like, oh, I didn't even really think that was that bad. Or I didn't think it was that funny, but apparently people thought it was hilarious.
Yeah. But I could definitely relate to, if I'm sitting writing it, I could almost imagine the way Mima has the pop idol version of herself.
Yeah.
Is that how you see yourself?
Telling herself. Yeah. No, it's the clowns in my head. Like, they keep I try to write something else and they're like, just kill her. Just set her on fire. And I'm like, no, I'm trying to write a letter to the bank, and it's like, no, tell them you're gonna burn it down. I don't actually have clowns in my head. That's just a thing that I'm making up.
You're just always trying to suppress your inner Joker.
Yeah.
Well, I should just one.
But we do thank you for coming back on here and recommending Perfect Blue to us. Well, thanks for letting me get to go and relive it again, because it's been a little bit, and Dave
I got to enjoy it for the first time.
Needs to expand his repertoire into anime.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, I guess a week from now, but it'll be about 3 weeks in the future, you'll go ahead and drop a little juicy teaser for your upcoming project.
I'll be, by the time this comes out, I hope even the cover part treats will be. It's currently with the artist. I've seen a sketch and very, very, very happy with what he's sketched. It is badass. And also that the punk band, the Antibodies, who wrote and performed the song for Sewer Sharks, have composed an instrumental for the book itself that will go on the audiobook, and it'll be on the soundtrack and everything for it. But it'll be the second time, it'll have its own original instrumental theme, which is just something I couldn't even imagine having before. And That's thanks to the awesome Antibodies, who, like, they reached out about wanting to do something, like, you know, song for one of my books a while back, and they've done music for, like, Trauma and things like that. Really cool stuff.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. Now, if only, you know, they could, if I could get an in with Uncle Lloyd at Trauma, they could do Sewer Sharks.
Yeah.
They don't even need to film it in Florida, right? We could just get a little stretch of New Jersey and pretend it's Florida. That'll work even better because it'll look just wrong and funny.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
And I also believe, I'll say it out on this thing, that probably the week before this drops, we're going to go ahead and do our big book giveaway, which is going to include October Society as well as Cotton Candy Massacre Part 1 and 2.
Oh, that's very kind of you. That's a lot.
I'll do two giveaways usually. One, I'll have a certain amount of stuff, and then a secondary prize. So I enjoy doing them, and everybody gets really into it. And they always get excited when Christopher Robertson is dropping some books into the some of his books are in the prize giveaway.
Yeah. Well, I'm always overwhelmed and incredibly appreciative. I don't understand why.
You're just scared of success is all.
I don't understand why they like it. A lot of things scare me, yeah, especially like the pigeons. But
but you do got a legitimate following, especially on Insta. I know a lot of people will be looking forward to this upcoming giveaway and your announcement.
Yeah.
This is especially nice. This is the first year without a new October Society book. And every time I say that, someone asks me, does that mean there's one next year? And I think I wrapped that series up in such a way that I would be afraid to touch it again, lest I spoil the magic and spoil the everything that it built to.
I'd much rather something just end on a high note with people wanting more rather than like losing its luster.
People wanting RDJ back as Iron Man. It's like,
really?
Yeah, I'm not going to Matrix for it.
Yeah.
I would return to the world.
Yeah.
If I could do it in the right way, it would have to be the absolute right way. And I think for that idea, I'm only maybe about 20% of the way there to what that could look like and how it could work.
So you're saying it's possible?
It's not. There's no point in me saying I'll never do it or anything like that. I would like end up writing.
I'm sure
certainly enough people love it that I feel like I would owe it to them. But I have ideas and ways. Maybe do a little bit more in that world without like spoiling the original. Like one idea I've batted around for a little while is doing perhaps like a standalone Christmas special.
I was about to ask if you would it be better, kind of like how you were talking about with Part Trees, would you have just maybe a nice standalone for that world?
So I thought I'd do like a Christmas special that takes place before the first book, and that way it doesn't mess with any of the overall plot lines, and you can just get that.
It could be its own thing.
PG-13 nostalgia in a slightly different setting from the main books. Because there's lore and story reasons why the stories always take place on the main story always takes place around Halloween. So taking place at Christmas would be a little bit different, but there would be an in-universe reason for it that would make sense. The dream goal for the October Society for what I would love to achieve with it, but I'm just wary of doing this because it would require like fundraising and taking people's money up front, which I'm very wary of doing things that. Like that.
And
I much prefer to be able to the transaction. I actually like to be hands off with the money as much as possible. That's why I it's not really practical to run a website from Britain because most of the people buy my books are like American or Canadian. So the export fees would be ridiculous. But it will always weird me out people buying my books. And if I was selling books at a convention, I'd be so like weird taking money.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It just makes me uncomfortable. Like I wish I could afford to just give them away, but like they cost a lot of money to put together and put out.
Yeah.
Like it's not like editing and cover art and stuff. It's not cheap.
But you hear that, everybody? Like you can't rush success. He's thinking about it. He's thinking about it.
What I would love to do, and I've spoke about this with my audio producers that do the other books, about if we had the funding to bring on a couple of extra voice actors, because the October Society is always, it's like six different children and they're telling story. If we could get like a small team of maybe like five or six different people that could be assigned to certain characters that do different distinct voices, and then do it like not as an audiobook, but as like YouTube episodes. Like every single story is an individual episode,
yeah,
with some like minimal animation. You know, like I don't know if you guys are familiar with YouTube channels like Lo-Fi Girl and stuff, where there's okay, just like, yeah, repeating looped animations. So things like that, that are unique to each episode, like just maybe like a couple of looping static, almost static, but slightly animated images, like nothing expensive, it's awfully expensive to produce, but atmospheric. And the one key thing I would love to do then doing that is to like replicate the commercials for real, because the series, the books have fake commercials in them.
This whole thing sounds like a very exciting undertaking.
Yeah.
It's the financing is not something I could do out of pocket.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's always what it comes down to at the end of the day. Yeah.
And then it's looking at the idea of kickstarting and things like that. And I'm not good at managing anything like that and promoting things and running that sort of stuff. And I wouldn't have even that first idea how much money it would actually take. I suppose I could be proactive and look into it and speak to some animators and stuff. But
yeah,
it's something I would like to do. It's just not something that's necessarily easy to do. But it's why I've held off on the October Society being an audiobook, because the October Society Season 1 is my second best-selling audiobook, my second best-selling book, like by quite a considerable margin. And I would, even if it was an audiobook, I would like to have a full cast.
Yeah.
Because there's just too many different voices.
Yeah.
But I would love to have it animated.
Well, if it ever comes to fruition, I'll do it for free. Sounds like a fun project, so if you need a free voice actor, I'm available.
I will charge a moderate fee, but you'll get what you pay for. So Dave, you'll get Dave for free, but you get what you pay for. But I'll earn every cent that I charge on my recording fee.
So the practicality. I mean, I'm writing this down that you promised that, Dave.
I'll do it.
I would legit do it too. It's doing audio books is something that we've like tossed around before, an idea of.
Yeah, I would say, because you guys have got good chemistry together and you do record together. If you were able to, offering like multicast and dual cast and split cast and stuff like that is great for audiobooks.
Yeah.
Some books work really well. Like just off the top of my head, you two guys could probably do really well in the field of dark romance and MM Smut.
I like that. Yeah. No, just Dave, you hear that, Dave? Experts in the field of dark romance smut.
Yeah.
Just some male on male smut. You guys.
That's how I'm going to start introing our show from. Oh, yeah. You guys know what time it is. It is Body Bag Podcast time. With Chris Bo. I had a name. No. I do these
Chris,
recordings.
Chris Boner and David.
Chris Boner Barnes. I do all of my recordings in the nude.
Oh, joke's on you guys. It's roasting here in Scotland. What do you think I'm doing right now?
Oh, it's 100. It's 100 and something degrees over here on the East Coast.
Yeah, it's pretty hot out here too. So.
Yeah, but those Scottish aren't built for heat. So if it's a little bit warm, we're like, we're dying. It's Mad Max.
Most people don't have AC out there, so.
No, I mean, we are probably, we're starting to see more AC stuff on sale over here.
Yeah.
But it's not a standard, it's not like a built-in.
Yeah.
But thanks again for coming on and spending a hot 2 hours of nostalgia, of animation, of just pop culture in general.
Yeah. It's a really fun episode to record. And we appreciate all you guys still listening. Have a good week, everybody.
Thank you guys for having me back on, especially after popcorn.
And we next time we do Terminator.
Yeah.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Body Bag Podcast. Be sure to like and subscribe and leave us a comment as to what you'd like to hear us review or any horror movie topics you'd like to hear us rant and rave about.
And while you're at it, you can find us on Twitter at Body Bag Pod and on Instagram at Body Bag Podcast.
Thanks, and we'll see you next time.